Episode 9, Part 2, The Siege of Vervenhithe. The first trick a political officer of the Commissariat learns is learn to lie. The second is trust no one. The third, never get involved in local politics. Commissar General Delane Oktar. Over the next 5 days, the Vervenhithe defenders licked their wounds and reorganized, preparing for the next big push. Artillery fire was continuous, but with the void shields activated, the bulk of the hive was free from damage. Vervea Gate was wedged open by the colossal wreck of the spider tank, which had been brought down by pinpoint artillery fire as it pushed the gates open. Unable to close the gates, the Imperial forces fortified and entrenched around the gate opening, digging trenches, allowing them to create a kill zone around the area. This was a reasonably open stretch of land, as it was formerly the transportation hub, where rail trains from the other hives would come and go with trade resources. Colonel Corbeck and a contingent of ghosts were still stationed here to stiffen the Vervan primary units, and the Northcoal forces, which had deployed in full strength along with their artillery. Day 33, the second storm. The Zoikans now concentrated their attack on three vulnerable points, rather than generally across the whole hive. They launched mass artillery bombardments and pushed at these three weakened points in their defences. The defences of Vervea were almost overrun at the start of this attack, and it appears that Colonel Modine, the Vervan primary commander for the area, suffered from a break in morale, unable to cope with the situation, and Colonel Corbeck of the 10th 1st and Colonel Bulwar of Northcoal enacted a secret arrangement known as Anvil to take command of the sector in the event the Vervan Hive commander failed to do his duty. The assault on Sondair Gate ended with a relatively swift victory for the Imperial defenders, which, after 2 hours of hard fighting, forced the Zoikans to withdraw. Colonel Grismond, commanding his Narminian armoured forces, lined up in the square of marshals, in a mirror of the Vervenhithe tanks which had done the same before their sally forth and swift annihilation over a month before. Colonel Grismond, who would later achieve the rank of General, redeployed to Vervea before it fell, along with two Vervan primary mechanised regiments and a Volpoon battle group. Unfortunately, the orders from Hive Command were imprecise, and the massed mechanised forces became bogged down in traffic along the roadways of the sector, throttling their movement so that only a trickle of the tanks managed to push in to support the Northcoal, Tanith and Vervan primary troops, which were being punished by the Zoikans. Grismond, growing furious, ordered his tanks off the main routes and gunned them through the industrial buildings, smashing through factory complexes, chain link fences, and following any routes which would allow them to escape the logjam and reach the front. Eventually, VPHC forces interposed themselves between the racing tanks, halting them and demanding they return to the highway. Grismond dismounted his tank, arguing with the VPHC that the route was necessary, whatever damage it may do to the facilities. In the argument that followed, one of the VPHC commissars drew a pistol and was punched by Grismond for the insult. He was arrested along with four of his officers, leaving the battle-hungry Narminians strung out and leaderless, watched by the growing number of VPHC forces surrounding them. This was just one of the terrible events to occur this day due to a lack of discipline and coordination between the off-world guard and the local PDF. And generally, pointed to a lack of proper command and control from Hive Command, which showed its faults clearly in the midst of this battle. A friendly fire incident occurred when a Vervenhithe mechanised force with Hydra flat cannons opened fire upon the Volpoon rushing to Vervea. Believing that the Zoikans had broken through the gate and had surrounded them, 13 men died needlessly. The command structure broke down as the inexperienced Vervenhivers, whose only experience of war was drills and practice exercises, could not cope with the changing situation. Worse, the Hive's military communication network was modelled on those of the Imperial Guard, and, unfortunately, used the same channels as the Guard, meaning that vox between the different areas was confused, as Imperial Guard and Vervenhithe forces spoke over one another, meaning that no one could communicate effectively, without interference, except for close-range vox between individual squads nearby. General Nash and his Rowan Deepers stationed at Crowgate was able to re-establish full command of his forces using a wideband transmission his forces had been forced to rely upon during a previous campaign, and was a trick his officers were well aware of. The Volpund had comparable success, but their choice was a band hampered by intense static caused by the void shield. At Crowgate, the enemy bombardment of the adamantine walls was growing so intense that the walls, somehow, were beginning to dent and glow with the hits from the continuous bombardment of solid shot, rocket, and explosive shells. General Nash organised his meagre armoured forces directly inside the gates to counter the 500-strong Zuykin armoured force visible beside the tracks leading to the gate, as well as the mass infantry force which was visible on the outskirts of the ruined house. Nash understood that the gate could not fall with Vervea in such a terrible situation, as two breaks in the wall would strangle the disorganised defenders, allowing the enemy to stream into the hive before troops could be organised and pushed to counter. The fighting at the half-open Vervea gate was intense. Zuykin forces pushed forward, taking horrendous casualties in the process, but attempting to forge a beachhead and secure this point of entry. Wave after wave of Zuykin infantry advanced into the breach, with the defenders on the walls and the defenders inside the breach mowing them down, but it was gradually taking its toll. With reinforcements filtering through slowly, the possibility of a Zuykin victory was still in the balance. As the Zuykins advanced, the Imperial forces were gradually forced back by the mass volleys of firepower from the advancing Zuykin cohorts. However, visibility became limited and street fighting began building to building, enabling the Tanith contingent to utilise squad tactics and the terrain and buildings to best effect. This allowed them to surround advancing units, catching them in crossfires as they advanced further into the hive. The Imperial forces halted the advance and managed to catch the Zuykins in the large open spaces surrounding the Vervea gate, in the area of the railhead, which was formerly used for trade and rolling stock. The gate itself was still contested by Imperial forces led by Colonel Korbeck, but Zuykin forces continued to push around their defensive positions and advanced as cited earlier. But with the gate contested still, the Imperium gradually began to check, annihilate and secure a united front line around the gates. The Zuykin forces pushed on relentlessly, hoping that by sheer weight of numbers they could secure the victory. They began to chant, marching in column behind the banners bearing the heraldry of Ferrozuyka and other dark runes and glyphs devoted to the dark gods. Korm Kolvik prepared to be overwhelmed when mass lasfire began to cut the Zuykins apart. 9 platoons of Vervan Primary marched upon the gate and turned the tide. Led by the hero of Vervenhive, Commissar Kell, their timely arrival saved the defenders from annihilation and turned the enemy forces, with the few remaining Zuykins forced to flee back through the gate. Kell had left High Command at dawn when the attack began, and unable to contact any command channels, he gathered forces as he advanced to Vervea, taking 6 hours on foot, bypassing the blocked highways and thoroughfares to reach the front. North Carl Armour and men supported the flanks of this rough and ready force, slaughtering the fleeing Zuykins. The Tenith had held the gate alone for an hour, taking terrible casualties due to the mismanagement of the Vervenhive command, but it was Commissar Kell who would be known as the hero, quite rightly, for his personal bravery and decisive action, as well as the images of him firing at the enemy and holding the breach with the banner of Vervenhive in his hand, which would be distributed throughout the hive, showing the people's hero had once again achieved victory. The gate was soon secured, with additional reinforcements filtering in, along with 50 Northcarl tanks, their guns facing the breach. The Zuykins withdrew across the hive with this reversal and the loss of uncountable dead. The Imperial forces' death toll was great at Vervea Gate alone and adjacent spoil sector, which the Zuykins had also struck in force. 500 Vervenhive elite spoilers, 3,500 Vervenhive primary, 900 Northcarl, and near 100 Tanith had fallen, with many more wounded. Shortly after this victory, Colonel Commissar Gaunt arrived and immediately made for the Vervenhive command position. There, he ordered the arrest of the officers present and summarily executed Colonel Modil for cowardice. In the aftermath of this victory, many in the Hive began to believe that this was the turning point, and as the public box system gave the news of the battle, a desperate public began to think the storm had passed, and parties and feasts began in the upper and lower hives. The worst of these celebrations was broken up by the VPHC. If they thought the Zuikens were defeated, they would be soon rudely awakened from this delusion. Day 35. The Imperial forces licked their wounds and fortified the inner gate of Vervia, and within 12 hours they had raised concrete concentric defensive walls and dug extensive trenches using the many work gangs as labour. Vervia was no longer a weak point, but had become a death trap, with the entrance into the Hive a kill zone for any Zuikan forces trying to force it. The Tanith manned the position as well as the elite Blue Blood 10th Brigade of Volpoon stormtroopers, which attempted to work better together despite previous grievances between the two formations. Political manoeuvring and strife continued amongst the High Command and the Vervan Hive nobility. Commissar Kal, figuring that his great service to the throne in this conflict would lend weight to his requests for a return to active frontline service in the Crusade, manoeuvred to achieve this, using his notoriety as the people's hero for his own purposes. None can doubt his personal bravery or prowess at war, but looking back upon these events, it is clear that even if only subconsciously, Kal saw this war as an opportunity to restart his career. To that end, he sided with the Vervan Hive Command in its incarceration of General Grismond for disobeying orders when he diverted his armoured column through the property of nobles when rushing to reinforce the breach at Vervia. Also, he supported General Sturm and Marshal Crow, who argued against a sally forth by Imperial forces and a continuation of a defensive war, rather than risk their armour outside the Hive's defences. Gaunt was not best pleased by this turn of events, and sought to see the release of Grismond, knowing he was a superlative armoured commander and would be needed to lead his Narminians, one of the elite armoured formations in the entire Crusade roster. But having recently executed a high-ranking Vervan primary officer, and being one of the Imperial Guard forces to criticise the shortcomings of the High Command, he had no sway as yet. So for the moment, this clique remained in control of the Imperial forces, and Grismond was held under arrest, facing trial. Ever is the way that personal ambition and hubris harm the affairs of man, even when their doom stands before them. At nightfall, the Zuikens resumed their bombardment of the city, and the noise of shells striking the walls and the constant discharge of the voids reverberated throughout the city. The Tanith, attached to the Vervan Hive forces defending the spoil, deployed scouts and sniper teams into this rough terrain, advancing 2 kilometres into the spoil, fighting skirmishes with Zuikan infiltrators and snipers along the way. This shadow war would continue throughout the conflict, with snipers on both sides hunting each other. Scout Sergeant McColl would be the first to report the new chant rising from the Zuikan lines. Heritor Asphodel. Heritor Asphodel. The next Zuikan thrust did not come from where it was expected, but from the northeast. The Promethean pipelines from the recently glassed Vanic Hive had been ordered closed and sealed to halt such a situation. But one guilder, filled with greed and seeing that the Promethean continued to flow, disobeyed this command, gaining a massive profit for his house in the cut-off hive. One can blame the Hive's authorities for not noticing the situation, or at least not checking that the orders of High Command had been followed, but the blame lies with Gilder Amkendurst Warlan. May his name be remembered in infamy. Before Warlan could be brought to justice by Makarov's staff shortly after the siege, he was killed when his other crimes of murder were discovered by a recovering Gaunt after he had attempted to murder and thus silence Medical Officer Dorden and Surgeon Anna Kurth. Using these pipelines, Zuikan sappers infiltrated on Tarby Gate Fortress, or as it was also known, Haz East. Placing mines in the foundations and around this bastion, they detonated a surprise attack, demolishing a large chunk of the fortress and cracking the defences of Vervenhive. With the foundations of the wall shattered, arch-enemy artillery began to pound the remains. The Imperial defenders scattered in confusion as the bombardment and the raging fires swept across the walls and the fortress. Haz East had fallen. The guard forces on the scene, including elements of the Tanith 1st and Rowan Deepers, deployed to bolster the Vervan primary regiments and reacted commendably quickly, beginning a strong defence of the breach. But against the firepower now firing from directly below the void shields and directed into the hive through the broken defences, there was little they could do but withdraw or die. A fighting retreat began into the urban areas of the hive against the advancing arch-enemy infantry, and then mass armoured forces moving into the hive through the breach they had carved through with a combination of mines, artillery and heavy energy cutting beams. 10 kilometres south from Haz East, at Crowgate, General Nash spotted an enemy armoured formation of 1,000 vehicles advancing around the hive to the breach at Untarby Gate. Across the hive's defences, Zuikin forces began to attack. Crowgate was now receiving massive bombardments. Infantry forces were assaulting the Spoil and Vervea Gate. Mass heavy armour and infantry formations were assaulting everything from Sondare Gate to Haz West Fort, and everywhere the vox and throats of the Ferrozoican heretics exclaimed, "Herator Asphodel, Herator Asphodel." At Hive Command, Marshal Crow furiously refused the suggestion of General Sturm to evacuate the city and flee across the river, telling him, "You were sent here to defend Vervan Hive, and that's what you'll do." He ordered the release of General Grismond and the execution of any VPHC official that stood in the way. Sturm, with Grismond, was ordered to Vervea Gate, and Sturm was to take command of that defence. Marshal Crow donned his personal war gear, and with his staff, left to command the defence of Sondare Gate in person, stating, "Vervan Hive lives or dies tonight." It was at this moment that Salvador Sondare's mind finally broke from the whispers of the traitors of Ferrozoica, playing upon his paranoia and ambition, convincing him to deactivate the shield. The effect was immediate. A subsonic boom washed across the city, blowing windows out across the hive. The temperature dropped by 6 full degrees instantly as the intense energies of the shield disappeared, and the smoke from the fires raging across the defences was sucked into the hive, covering it in a dense acrid fog lit by the great pylon burning itself out with the suddenly disconnected energies, like a vast, furious candle in the centre of the city. Not only this, but there arose a great rumble of noise from the throats of every Ferrozoican throat, a terrifying cry of triumph as they saw victory was at hand and pushed on with ever more fury. Behind the main enemy lines, artillery adjusted their aim. Marshal Crow arrived at Crowgate, armed and armoured in the finest equipment available, just as the shield collapsed, and watched with horror as the true power of the enemy's massed artillery unleashed itself on the city. The walls shuddered. Troops, civilians, defences, ramparts, all blown apart by firepower held at bay by the shield for so long. Crow could not leave, knowing that the defenders would lose heart if they saw their commander withdraw at this critical moment. So, raising the sacred blade of Hieronymo Sondare high, he ran to the wall to lead the defence. Suspecting, however, this was no technical fault, he ordered his lead bodyguard to return to the hive on his authority to deal with the situation. Across the hive, death came. Wave after wave of enemy shells smashed into the central hive, slaughtering untold thousands in those first moments. It is estimated that 2.5 million civilians and refugees began to flee north towards the river, hoping to escape the hive and the coming horror. The hive became an inferno as fires raged across it, with the continued boom of shell detonations adding to the chaos. Along the railways leading to the hive, the Ferrozoicans brought up vast rail-bound artillery pieces which launched huge shells into the hive, as well as rockets and fire from uncounted Earthshaker barrels. Sergeant Vall, leading a mixed force of guardsmen from Haz East into the hive's hab zones, entered into running battles with Zuikin insurgents who had pushed further into the city via the Promethean pipelines at the same time as the sappers were causing chaos behind the hastily prepared Imperial defences. General Zants attempted to move up and reinforce the eastern situation when he and his force of 700 Northcoal troops in Chimera APCs were hit with pinpoint artillery, presumably called in by Zuikin infiltrators acting as spotters, annihilating the force in a period of minutes. before they could reach the front and help to stem the tide. As the shields collapsed, House Command fell to chaos. And the commanding officer there, and second-in-command of Vervenhard's military, Vice Marshal Anko, broke. His mind was unable to comprehend the information flooding the tactical maps and arrays, and the calls for orders and assistance from across the hive at this critical moment. Stepping away from the tactical display, he smoothed the front of his white dress uniform, adjusted his belt, and drew his auto pistol. He shot the table 8 times, and it is reported that he then shot 2 of the aides nearby, before proceeding to the end of the balcony the command station sat on, overlooking the PAC command center, and began to fire into his own men. It is here that we see the difference between planetary organizations and imperial ones, for instead of executing this mind-broken commander, as any righteous true commissar of the Progenium would have, a VPHC officer and 2 servitors try to wrestle him instead, perhaps out of fear of slaying this high-ranking native. Whatever their reason, Anko blew the VPHC officer's head off, and reloading his pistol, continued to fire into his own men. This would be a bad enough situation for House Command, leaving the embattled Imperial forces starved of information and leadership. But then, a vast missile, fired directly at Hive Command, smashed through the observation window in a whirlwind of glass, which alone shredded Anko and the majority of the command staff, before detonating, turning Vervenhive's House Command into a burned-out crater in the Hive's surface. Across the Hive, the overwhelming power of the Ferrozulkin artillery was decimating it. The Basilica of the Ecclesiarchy east of the Commercia, which had stood for 2,000 years through the settlement wars, the colonial uprising, and the Podesto-Gurvandi power struggle, and all the other wars and uprisings of Vervenhive's history, was demolished by sustained bombardment from a battery of earthshakers, which caused rivers of lead to form from the molten remnants of the mighty church's roof. At Crowgate, General Nash proved his worth when he managed to not only hold off the attacks from outside the gate, but also gathered a force of Rowan Deepers and Vervan Primary to push north to help to stem the tide of heretic forces. As one of the heroes of this terrible moment, he managed to secure the gate and knock out the enemy's thrusts while moving a third of his force, some 1,500 Deepers and 3,500 Primary, northwards to push back against the breach at Antabi Gate. The Deepers, normally considered lazy and too easygoing by Crusade Command, showed their prowess in this push, slaying 4,500 Zulkin troops and destroying around 100 armoured units, holding their advance south from the breach dead in its tracks for 2.5 hours, before they too were overrun by sheer numbers. The fighting became so intense and brutal in the Habs and streets that General Nash would fall in a ruined worker Hab before dawn, after being shot 19 times before his last position was overrun and the Zulkins finally moved deeper into the Hive. At Sondar Gate, the situation was a madman's vision of war. As artillery shells flew back and forth, and the night was lit by fire, explosions, and the constant zap of thousands of las rifles firing continuously, Zulkin stormtroopers raised ladders and brought forward siege towers in anachronistic defiance of the advanced weaponry being unleashed all around them. These siege towers, resembling vast mechanical praying mantae, used enormous mechanical claws to rip the front of the parapets away and pull down the walls' towers before, locking their limbs together, formed plates or ramps which saw a flood of Zulkins charge directly onto the walls, finally taking them. Marshal Crowe died fighting and would later be found bayoneted through the heart. Sondar Gate had fallen. The defence of Vervea Gate and the spoil was under Colonel Cordray and Major Rawn, and they fought it fiercely for 6 hours, holding back the Zulkin attack, which came relentlessly, no matter how many they slew. Ammunition was beginning to run down, and they could not contact House Command nor any other unit, so simply continued to hold their position against the Zulkin onslaught. The Tanith snipers and scouts stationed at the spoil wreaked a massive toll on the Zulkin infiltrators and stormtroopers attempting to break through, but were held in check. And though they kept coming, the outside and gateway of Vervea was a charnel house of dead Zulkins, and broken armoured vehicles. Colonel Corbeck's troops and the North Col, under Colonel Bulwer, had been pulled back from the wall for 2 nights for rest and recuperation, and now advanced back towards the gate, the Ghosts heading west and the North Col east, where they could deploy to Crow or Vervea, depending upon the situation. Corbeck eventually made contact with Cordray, informing him that Sundare must have fallen and to prepare for attacks to the rear, as his force of some 300 Tanith were now locked in street fighting with Zuykens, attempting to strike at the gate, exclaiming, "This is the one, boys! Do it right or die here!" The Tanith forces at their billets were ordered to evacuate to the Kenwaste ground surrounding their position when the shield fell. Sergeant Bray, in command there, reasoned that the rough terrain would be a better position for the Tanith to dig in and use their skills to the best, rather than remain in a fixed position in a warehouse area which could not be easily defended. This was a canny move by the sergeant, considering he had no orders nor contact with any higher ranking authority, as just as the Ghosts began to dig in and entrench themselves, the billets and the entire area they had been stationed in was targeted with heavy bombardment, which would have seen the whole force of some 500 Tanith annihilated in one fell swoop. As they could not yet determine what the wider situation was, only that the shield was down and a general attack was taking place, with the fog of war descending upon them, it was the initiative of these veteran officers which enabled the Imperial forces to compose a rough sort of defence in these crucial hours of chaos. Within the VPHC facility, a gunfight had erupted during the attempted execution of General Grismond, with the Volpoon under General Sturm coming to rescue and liberate the Narminians. Commissar Kell was stripped of his rank and placed under arrest by Gaunt for attempted subversion of Imperial law. Grismond would return to his regiment while Gaunt and the Volpoon would ascend to the heights of the Hive to reactivate the shield and remove Salvador Sundare from his position. At the same time, the Lord Chase and Marshal Crow's bodyguard were doing the same thing, and the three forces joined together, fighting through the now clearly corrupted ruler of Vervenhive, Servitor bodyguards. Salvador Sundare had been broken in body and mind, and fallen utterly to chaos, in his insanity, festering in his insanity within his amniotic tank. He had pledged himself to Herator Asphodel, and as a reward he had been gifted with a chaotically corrupted servitor, a mechanical horror of enormous proportions. Sundare's fascination with his meat toys was infamous in the noble houses, and many efforts had been made to curtail his surgical whims and clone farming over the years. From a history of Verdast, this thing was truly terrible, more even than the deluded creation of a mad flesh engineer. The insanity of the warp was in it, 1800 kilos of scarred meat and gristle, bigger than a hurricane antelodon, a jigsaw of human parts fused into the carcass of a wild uruk from the grasslands. Limbs twisted and writhed around it, some with grasping hands, some animal, some wet, glistening pseudopods like muscular feet of giant mollusks. The massive head was an eyeless mouth of needle teeth that smacked slackly and gurgled. The donor oryx's vast horns swept outwards from the low skull crest. A multitude of cables, feeder tubes and wires suspended it, but unlike the other meat puppets, this thing moved of its own volition, pouring and stamping the soft carpet, writhing and pulsing. The smell was overwhelming. From a history of the later Imperial Crusades. A terrifying combat ensued as the beast took the punishment of the surviving force. The Volpoon elite racked the beast with Hellgun fire, and it took this punishment, along with fire from the rest of the force. It was in this moment that Commissar Kell sacrificed himself and regained his honour, when he threw himself at the beast with a canvas web of grenades taken from one of the fallen. This is one of the reasons Commissar Kell has not been expunged from Imperial records, and in the popular consciousness of the citizens of Vervenhive, he is still remembered as the people's hero, for the muddy details of earlier events have not been divulged to the general populace. Gilbert, given permission by Gaunt as a kind of payment for the Volpoon saving the Commissar in this struggle, was allowed to end Salvador. He fired his Hellgun through the amniotic tank's viewing porthole, leaving the writhing and decrepit ruler in the now fluidless tank, before firing a grenade in to finish the job. The mortally wounded Lord Chase was the only one who could reactivate the shield, its systems being locked to any but those with the genetic code of one of the noble born, and he did manage this before he succumbed to his wounds, saying in his last moments, "Sic semper tyrannis." The Last Ditch. With the shield reactivated, the Zeukans were deprived of their advantage, and despite their vast numbers, the defenders now had a chance to counter. Cordray and Rorn extracted their forces and withdrew from Vervea Gate before they could be encircled, adding to the Imperial forces' formation of a strong line of defence within the Inner Hive, as the Imperial forces withdrew from the walls in a vast fighting withdrawal until they could find firm ground and set up a solid front. Colonel Corbeck's troops, holding the warehouse of Guild Gathran Agriculture, formed the centre of the line, with retreating units forming up alongside this ramshackle defence. In the northeast, Sergeant Vall, with a mixed force of 170 men from Tanith, Primary and Deepers, was holding the northern shore and the now burning docks. Heretic Armour had taken the bridge and were pushing forces directly into the Hive, with the Promethean depots now ablaze and the few Imperial units in the area withdrawing before the enemy. The end seemed nigh, but relief was coming. Commissar Colonel Gaunt now took command. Major Ott, the senior surviving Vervan primary commander, presented Gaunt with the sword of Hieronymo Sundare and handed command of the Hive to him. General Sturm had been found attempting to flee with the refugees across the river. He was stripped of command and placed under arrest after treacherously ordering the evacuation of the city and attempting to shoot Gaunt. Many grave events for the Imperium would stem from this moment, but we will cover them later. Although technically General Grismond had higher rank, Armour are always subservient to infantry commands. Gaunt took command and began to reorganise and provide leadership to the shattered Imperial forces. This had an immediate effect. Word was also sent to Crusade Command, with Gaunt stating, "I will not ask Makarov for aid, but I want him to understand the situation here. If he deems it worthy of his notice, he will assist us." The newly released General Grismond rejoined his Narminiad Armoured and immediately drove this elite regiment towards Antabi and Crow Gates to counter the incoming Zeukan armoured forces flowing into the city, stating, "Let's give them hell!" The Northcarl armoured groups, left without direction in the centre of the Hive, were ordered south to Sundare Gate and to reinforce the Tanith forces under Colonel Corbeck. Imperial units across the Hive were contacted and received orders from Gaunt. Known as a strong infantry commander and frontline officer, Gaunt had never been given the opportunity of high command, and this is looked back upon as a defining moment in his career, where Crusade Command noted his skill and ability as he forged a concerted defence and counterattack against the Zeukan Horde. Many reflected that he reminded them of Slado in this moment, showing drive and purpose, being able to handle information and direct forces which would have been viewed as an impossible task by many commanders. This was noted amongst even the highest echelons of the Crusade. It was during this time that the Scratch Companies made themselves known. Civilians and workers, as well as Vervan primary troopers who had been separated from their units over the last several weeks, had formed into companies, armed with whatever weaponry they could find, battling it out in the vicious street fighting that erupted since the Zeukans pushed into the city, and before, with many being left stranded outside the walls in occupied territory. Many of these bands had been formed, but still to this day it is unknown how many. As Colonel Bulwer's Northcarl divisions were being cut to pieces at crossroads FG/567 in the Eastern Habs by Heretic Armour and near overrun, he laid about him with his power claw and fired point blank with his auto pistol, believing this was the end, when, all of a sudden, a large contingent of these civilian militia came to their aid, led by a spoil worker known as Argon Sorek, a smeltery foreman before the war. using industrial equipment, such as mining charges looted from the storehouses of their workplaces, they merged with the regular troops, stabilizing the situation somewhat, and pushed back this latest wave of Zulkin attackers until the Narminian army arrived. General Grismond was fast becoming and would be a legend in the Sabbat Crusade, with his Narminian armoured forces being elite tank killers with an impressive kill count. Here, he showed his skill as a master of armoured warfare during engagements, which are still taught to trainee tank commanders to this day. The Narminian tankers were the elite, with only those capable of moving at pace and being able to fire accurately and repeatedly qualifying for entrance into the regiment. Having been ordered to advance to the east, Grismond marshalled his forces into a solid column, safe from the kind of punishment the Northcull armoured forces, with the shield now raised. He dispatched sentinel and foot-based spotters ahead, knowing that they could not give him the exact location of the enemy, but would be able to give estimates of their numbers and their direction of advance. He ordered his tank column south, then east, to catch the front of the enemy's armoured push in the flank. His plan was to launch a full tank strike and enact a personal speciality of theirs, the scissors. Once they had found the front wedge of the Zulkin armour, 40 Narminian heavy tanks gunned forward at full speed, firing into this surprise Zulkin armoured column, smashing through them before turning around on the far side to run through the damaged and confused enemy force. They had already destroyed 72 enemy armoured vehicles, but as they turned, the rest of the Narminian armoured began their assault, so that both sides would attack both flanks as one, and, showing the superiority of his tankers, they never suffered a single friendly fire casualty nor collision, as they had experience from conducting the scissors 9 times in previous campaigns. Using vox beacons to help distinguish who was friend from foe, the Narminians annihilated the Zulkin's push in the jaws of the scissors. Over the course of the 35th day, the Narminians conducted 3 more scissor strikes, breaking the Zulkins and forcing them back and back, littering the inner hive with the shattered, burned-out hulls of heretic armour. In a few hours, the Narminians had lost 2 tanks for 200 Zulkins, a fine tally which stabilised the front. But the heretics had an almost endless stream of armour to call upon. Come nightfall, all the units in the east were able to resupply and begin to push forward to support the Narminians' thrust. Towards Sonder and Vervair gates in the south, the situation was not as good. The Northcull armour had not the inspired leadership of Grismond, and Major Clodil, their commander, fell to straight-up duelling with the Zulkins in a crash of armour, which, although it held the line, saw no gains and a steady loss of Imperial tanks. With that, the 35th day ended. The city was shattered, the population were trapped, killed, or fleeing across the river. The battlements had fallen, and now the Imperial line was being held with intense city fighting to hold back the Zulkins pushing deeper. Without the Imperial forces, Vervenhive would already be broken, but with their support and example, the primary fought on for every inch of their home. It seemed they had only a few days left before they would be overrun, and even now the Zulkins were pushing hard to reach and destroy the shield pylon, with the Imperials being pushed back slowly towards the only thing giving them the edge in the struggle. That our beloved hive should be conquered, or should fall into controlling hands of unwise or unfit masters, I greatly fear and sadly anticipate. For this reason, I entrust this ultimate sanction to you. Use it wisely. Hieronymo Sonder to the Lord Chase. As Gaunt went to the Imperial Chapel at the new command centre, he was visited by one Merity Chase, the daughter of the recently deceased Lord Chase, who had sacrificed himself that day to reactivate the shield. She brought with her a relic, left in safekeeping with her family by the late great Hieronymo Sonder, to be used in only the most apocalyptic situations, though it is doubtful he saw this eventuality. No, his fear was that a more regular enemy, or an unfit ruler who would become a tyrant, would gain control of the democratic legislature of Vervenhive. Democracy, as all emperor-faring men know, is at minimum borderline heresy, but across the realm of man, all sorts of backward and nonsensical beliefs are allowed to fester, so long as the world in question does its duty and pays its tithe to him on Earth. She gave him a System Slayer, a potent tech weapon designed to, if used, fundamentally destroy the electronic and codifier capabilities of the Hive. The idea being that if a tyrant arose and had complete technological mastery of the Hive, by deploying this, the citizens would be able to revolt without the tyrant using the systems and power of the Hive's infrastructure to protect themselves. Everything would shut down and die. That was the idea, anyway. House Chase had long specialised in the creation of codifier systems and sentient cogitators, under the supervision and partnership with the Adeptus Mechanicus, so had built this near doomsday device at the greatest Sundar's request to act as a weapon of last resort to defend the city and its freedom. On another matter, and before we go on, and for the sake of probity, please know that this is worth noting for the record only, and due to how events would later unfold for Colonel Commissar Gaunt, that it was on this night that he and the Lady Chase became intimate. The result of this encounter would emerge several years later. Day 36. The Spike. Has West Fort was now cut off and surrounded. Of the original 5,000 Vervan primary guardsmen and artillerymen manning the wall's guns, only a remnant of some 600 able men remained. The lower part of the fort was aflame and broken. Most of the guns were destroyed or out of ammunition, leaving this meagre remnant with only their las rifles. So it was a surprise that the fort and its gates still stood. With enemy forces entering the Hive from the south, they had encircled the fort, and its acting commander, Captain Cargan, estimated they could hold for another hour, if not reinforced. But reinforcements were coming to relieve them, fighting their way from the centre of the Hive, of the Hive's defensive walls. That was until the Spike came into range. The spotters on Has West Fort sighted it approaching from the west, a vast 500 metre high pyramid, moving upon multiple enormous caterpillar units, demolishing all in its path, leaving a half kilometre trail of destruction behind it as it slowly, but with unstoppable momentum, approached the Hive. Painted in the ochre of Ferrozoica, and with vast chaotic glyphs on its sides, it had enormous starship-level plasma weaponry based within it. This weapon lit and fired, annihilating Has West Fort in one enormous blast, punching yet another hole in the adamantine walls of the Hive. This again shows the horror of the forces of Chaos. For though they were in possession of this fearsome weapon, they did not use it until the end, and happily threw their deranged followers into certain death. Another thing that became clear to Gaunt and the Imperials was that this was the den of the heretic leader Heritor Asphodel. As this Spike, as it became known, was the source of the Vox signals calling his name, which permeated the Zoikin communications in a constant chant. The Imperials decided that they must strike at the Spike. The Hive may fall anyway, but would certainly if this fell weapon was brought to bear on the main spire. So, this offered a chance for survival, to reclaim some small measure of justice for the people of Vervan Hive, and potentially remove a grave threat to the Crusade by slaying this Heritor and perhaps, break the Chaos Horde, as had been seen in other campaigns, at the loss of their champions. So it was decided a strike team of the elite forces remaining drawn from the Volpoon and Tanith was gathered, along with guides selected from the Scratch Companies. They approached the Spike stealthily, a Tanith speciality, and climbed buildings the Spike was passing by to jump onto the fell machine. Gaunt himself using the power blade of Hieronymo Sundar to cut open hatchway. The strike team first struck at the main gun decks, clearing them of enemy presence, but they were unable to knock out the gun. They then fought their way through the Spike, coming up against elite heavy Zoikin troopers through the mass of the Spike's inner hallways, with enemy ambushes striking from every direction, bursting from the ceilings and flanks, using their knowledge of the structure to strike at the Imperials. But they fought through this, eventually reaching the command deck. During the firefight and melee that erupted, Gaunt fought his way, more by accident than design, to the central platform, which had upon it an energy-shielded dome, and was there met by the shimmering half-demonic Dark Watch bodyguard of the Herator. With all his skill, he fought these heretic elites, using the blade of Sundar to parry the chaos-tainted blades of these abominations. He beheaded one of these beasts in the furious swordplay that followed, but was wounded in the leg and fell. Trooper Bragg, cradling an autocannon single-handed, saved Gaunt from death when he made the platform and fired his heavy weapon point-blank on full auto into one of the beasts. The rest of the strike team, having cleared the command deck of enemy forces, quickly joined him, adding their fire to his. Two more of these fell creatures materialized on the platform, and one, wielding a cruel pike, managed to slay one of the team before its head was blown off from a Hellgun's underslung grenade launcher. The other two were eventually atomized as their corporeal forms could no longer withstand the whirlwind of Laz and Hardram striking them. Gaunt made for the main cogitator and logic stacks of the spike, attempting to unleash the system slayer of House Chase. The strike team were holding the entrance to the command deck against a horde of Zuikens attempting to fight their way through and retake it. And outside in the city itself, the Imperial forces were being pushed back, despite the heavy casualties they were inflicting upon the enemy. The spike also fired its main gun, the deck having been recrewed, and annihilated the shield pylon, removing Vervenhive's protection and allowing the Zuikan artillery to unleash its fury on the Hive once more. Gaunt inserted the System Slayer amulet, and with a perverse purr, it went to work. The lights flickered, two, three, and four times before cutting out completely, and the vast engine of death came to a sudden halt, all its power cut, leaving nothing but silence and darkness. With the vast machine dead, the shield dome in the center of the command deck collapsed, revealing its occupant, the Herator Asphodel himself. The Chaos Warlord stood, half demonic, with a cloak of shadow darker than the blackness of the lightless command deck. Gol Collier from the Scratch Company struck the creature with his axe rake, the tool of the labourer, and was thrown across the deck by a swipe of the beast's fist. Scout Sergeant McCall shot it twice, but was also sent through the air with a broken shoulder. Domar's lasgun blew up in his hands as he pulled the trigger. Others of the team were slain by the chaotic creature until Commissar Colonel Ibram Gaunt, bearing the sword of Hieronymo Sundar, thrust it into the beast's chest, up to the hilt, the blue power field illuminating the scene as the blade pierced the creature's back. For his efforts, and in a last act of malice, Herator Asphodel fired his bolt pistol into Gaunt's heart. With this act, we have richly denied the darkness and made trophies of its creatures. A dark lord is dead. So this holy crusade, blessed by the Emperor, is advanced to glory. Warmaster Makarov at Vargast. Day 50. Remembrance. Learning via the Astropathicus that Vervenhive faced not an inconsequential rival hive, but a hunted Chaos Commander, Makarov had made best speed for Vargast, arriving after 27 days of urgent transit through the warp. The hazy sky was full of metal and looked like it should fall. The awesome power of the Imperium was there for every Vargasite to see. 10,000 ships, some the size of cities, some bloated like ornate oceanic turtles, some slender and serrated like airborne cathedrals. Makarov unleashed his might upon the planet below. 6 million guardsmen, 500,000 tanks, squads drawn from 3 chapters of the Adeptus Astartes, 2 Titan Legions. Troop dropships, bulk machine lifters, and shuttles dropped in a swarm on the Haz Valley. For a while, the sky did fall. Mass destruction followed, lasting for 5 days. Though it was brutally one-sided. Hieronymo's amulet had done its work and cut the insidious chatter for all time. By the time the War Master's immense forces arrived, the Zuikens were already in total rout. Aimless and lost, they broke off the final assault, Many committed suicide or wandered blindly into the defenders' fields of fire to be massacred. Millions of others woke, as if from a dream, and stumbled without purpose or motive, back into the grasslands. Under Grisman's command, the battered Imperial forces that had held Verben High for over a month reformed to drive the pitiful, bewildered invaders out. Narminian and Norskarl tank brigades chased down and annihilated Zoikan motorized units, threading back across the grasslands, towards their own hive. Colonel Bulwer and Major Ott, utilizing every troop-carrying machine they could raise, hunted out and slaughtered the fleeing troop elements in vast numbers. There was no question of mercy. Ferrozoika's taint had to be expunged. By the time Makarov's armada made orbit, the Zoikans had been driven back 600 kilometers into the plains, leaving vehicles and equipment scattered and abandoned in their wake. In the crippled hive itself, Scratch Company slowly weeded out the last feral pockets of Zoikan resistance. The Warmaster followed up with unstinting vigor. He politely but determinedly requested the assistance of the Iron Snake Space Marine Chapter to overtake and neutralize the fleeing enemy. His armored brigades poured down the main highways and decimated everything that lived. Skeletal titans, shrieking like wraiths, stalked at the grassland horizons, incinerating the retreating foe. On the 54th day, Crusade warships torched Ferrozoika High from low orbit. The blinding flame flare filled the southern horizon. But by then, the fight was out of the Zoikans, and had been since the 37th day. Without the hypnotic chatter to unify their cause and drive them on, they had crumbled. Imperial Fist Space Marines ceremonially destroyed the spike and incinerated the Heritor's corpse. From a history of the later Imperial Crusades. The victory was won, but Vervenhive was dead. The Warmaster himself signed the dissolution warrant, leaving Vervenhive a dead and wrecked ruin. A necropolis. The noble families and people, however, would go on to form two new hives. Founded from the refugee population, each would take generations, and perhaps centuries, to match the productive capacity and size of dead Vervenhive. But they would, eventually, and Vargast would once again be an asset to the Imperium. One would be led by House Chase, which would devote itself to mining and servitor engineering. The other, under House Anko, would move in to exploit the now unoccupied Promethean Fields, once owned by Hive Vanek, which was now an irradiated crater. In the years to come, there would be rivalry and blood, as the descendants of these cities grew, and the horrors of the past were forgotten. Ambition and greed would once more set into their hearts. But those things are for another history. Additionally, the Warmaster signed the Act of Consolation, whereby any citizen of Vervenhive who felt that they no longer wished to live upon Vargast would be accepted into the ranks of the Imperial Guard, where they could escape their former lives and in the Holy Crusade gain absolution and favour in the God Emperor's eyes by slaying the heretic on other worlds. 40,000 took this offer, and for regiments like the Tanith, it was a boon, as so many ghosts had fallen that it would be fast approaching a troop strength where it would no longer be a sustainable fighting formation without the infusion of fresh recruits. Overnight, the dying Tanith First doubled in strength, taking into their ranks many of the Verben Primary and members of the Scratch Companies who did not wish to stay on a world with ghosts and sought a new life amongst the stars. Gaunt should have died from the Heritor's bolt, but the Emperor does indeed protect, and the shell was deflected by a metal flower which Merity Chase had gifted to him to wear and remember her by. He dropped the shards that Dr. Dorden had dug from his flesh into the waters of the River Haas as he boarded the ferry which had originally brought him to the Hive and where he had seen Hive Vanek die at the start of the campaign. A little later, a monument of remembrance was built, called the Chase Memorial, by the artist Thurow of Norskarl. It is a single guardsman, cast in steel made from the rendered down weapons of the fallen. It resembles a Tanith ghost, but only vaguely, being a memorial to all who fell. One fist is raised in eternal defiance. The War Master, though content and pleased with the securing of Vargas and the final destruction of one of the greatest enemy warlords arrayed against him, prepared for the next big push in the Crusade. The Cabal systems were the next great struggle, and would see the Imperial forces pushed to the limits across multiple fronts for the next 2 years, as Makarov attempted to take three of the notorious fortress worlds. During this struggle, a miracle happened, without which the Crusade may have lost heart and faltered. And we will cover those events next time. Thank you all very much for watching, and I want to say a big thanks to everybody who's supporting the channel. If you'd like to do that as well, please follow the links below. Otherwise, hopefully you've enjoyed this. I'll be working on improving the quality as we go along, and the next one isn't going to take 6 months like this one did. Again, thank you all very much for watching. If you wouldn't mind giving me a like, and remember to subscribe to the channel if you're not subscribed already. And yes, thanks again. This has been an enormous episode. So again, thank you for watching. I will see you next time. Cheers.